It wasn't just some old white guy writing it anymore. It was actually a part of the world that we live in. When we watch TV and we read books, all we want is to be reminded of all the problems of our world.
Before the Rings of Power, there were the Silmarils. Before Sauron, there was his master Morgoth. Before Aragorn and Arwen, there was the Rings of Power. Join us as we explore the Rings of Power with your hosts from theonering.com, Jonathan Watson and Michael Grumbine.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Exploring the Rings of Power, our favorite show that that has graced us, I don't know, since the films, at least.
Right. And and definitely best show of the last 5 years.
Oh, so bar none.
So we thought maybe we could come to you guys with an episode where we looked back, since we are coming up on the release of season two of the Rings of Power, mm-hmm. which I mm-hmm. cannot wait for. And right. and we're just we thought we'd go over some of our top moments in the first season of the Rings of Power,
as well as some top characters. I mean, it's the first day of a new quarter, the first day of the fourth month. So I thought it would be a great time to do that. It's a new season, right? Spring is here, April has come, and we're going to jump into the Rings of Power with both feet first. I mean, we do it every week, but even more this week because the news is going to start. It's got to start rolling in. It's been months, almost years.
I am waiting. Anything. Checking my feed every 5 minutes.
So before we jump into all those great details on the Rings of Power from your Tolkien super fans, Jonathan Watson and Michael Grumbine, I wanted to tell you should get a membership to theonering.com. By going to theonering.com/member, you get our extended podcast. The first month is free. It's $4 a month. And in that extended podcast this week, we're going to be talking about in more detail the other scenes of the Rings of Power that we're hoping for to see in season two. We've gotten 8 full episodes, of course. Episode two. Season two, which is coming this fall. They haven't released a date yet, but we're going to go into more details about what our favorite upcoming episodes are. Upcoming scenes are going to be probably Tom Bombadil.
Also, you know, I was thinking recently that about how much Tolkien loved song and music. Mm. And I think Rings of Power has kind of a perfect opportunity here. Now that we have kind of got to know the character of Sauron a little bit better. I'm looking forward to what they can do, giving Sauron a couple musical numbers, maybe some song.
I mean, at very least he needs poetry.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Exactly.
Black speech poetry. I mean, well, doesn't he come up with the ring verse? I mean,
maybe that's how we do it, right? Maybe right. It's like, you know, he's just right. rapping.
I mean,
and he's coming up with some right. verse.
Dropping. I mean, they did have a song on the soundtrack by Bear McCreary that is so memorable. Everybody remembers the ring verse song that they came out with in the soundtrack. All right. So become a member, theonering.com/member. And you can become a super fan of the Rings of Power too by going there. Just like Harrison, Adam, Lynn, and Rich, who give above and beyond, become sponsors. In fact, you can actually go to theonering.com/Patreon now to use your Patreon membership to become a member. It's $1 more at $5 a month. You get all the same perks. We're still finalizing all the setup with that, but if you just want to use Patreon because it's super easy, and the reason it's $1 more is because Patreon takes more of our hard-earned moolah, and it's not nice of them. So that's why we built it all on our website, so we're not beholden to anybody else. Anyway, Patreon and membership at theonering.com/member, theonering.com/Patreon. Okay, guys, The Rings of Power, probably the best show I've seen in years, and I wanted to just go back to some of the stats from the show that I think indicate its ascendancy in the pantheon of television shows, right? And that is, it got an 83% on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know if any show has ever gotten more than an 83%. That's like a B. That's really good.
Pretty
that's
better than tier. Pretty top tier.
Like, I've never gotten higher than that in school, so that's top tier. On Metacritic, it got a 71. I mean, that's a little bit lower, but it's still super high. I mean, has anything gotten better than the 71? I think Peter Jackson's films probably had like a 65 or something like that.
They're critics, right? So that's they're gonna
yeah
they're gonna
they have to work. They have to find all the
ding things a little bit. Yeah.
I mean, if you go there, I'm sure that the viewership numbers are going to be far higher for that. They're probably going to give it far better ratings if you go to Metacritic.
I doubt the Bible would get an 80% on Metacritic. So.
yeah. Well, the Bible. We don't need that. Who needs to look backwards anyway? As we'll find out because of what Ellen told us. The past is dead, Michael. Who needs to
right.
Bible, right? Let's also remember that 25 million people watched the first episode. Well, they sampled it. That was the word that Amazon used. They sampled it, but who doesn't like a good sample?
Attention spans are low these days.
Yeah, samples are great. And I'm sure of those 25 million people, many finished it.
I know I did.
It's great.
That's one. Yeah.
That's one. That's one out of, you know, that's a certain percentage. In fact, speaking of percentages, out of those that watched the first episode, out of those, a full 37% finished the show. That's huge. Can you imagine the amount of people, hundreds, dozens, thousands, that finished the show? And 37, that's a great batting average. That's huge.
Exactly. Like, that's a great point. As far as batting averages go, that's major right there. 37%.
One
370.
Yeah.
One of 370.
And they never struck out on the show either.
That's
you like joke. That? Okay. Who can't remember also the theme to the Rings of Power? The most memorable theme probably in any television show ever. I've always tried to remember the original, like, 1960 Batman theme, like, ba-da, ba-da, da, ba. I don't remember how that Batman theme goes, but the Rings of Power theme,
easy to remember.
No problem, right? You got it, right, Michael? Go for it. Go for it. It's so memorable. We love it. It's so good.
I have to go back and listen to it.
Super catchy. Yeah. No, I just like listening to you hum it. It's like the rays of sun shining on me from the heavens beyond. I love that theme. I love that theme.
Or the Light of the Silmarils.
The Light of the Silmarils. That's a little teaser.
Our favorite scenes in the Rings of Power we're about to jump into. And I don't know. You tell me when it's time. But
well, I've got a couple more things to mention. Okay. Or at least more. And that's the acting, right? The acting is tremendous. They were nominated for 6 Emmys for the show. It wasn't for the acting. None of it was. It was actually just technical Emmys. But if it wasn't for the acting, those costumes would not have looked anywhere near as good as they looked.
Yeah, I mean, look, costumes by themselves on the ground,
yeah,
useless. Right. So it's the actors that really brought it home.
And with those costumes, they used the best printing presses possible to make these costumes. It was incredible. Like, they looked so almost realistic.
My home printer could barely do as good as some of those Numenorean costumes, the armor, the Numenorean armor.
And you spent a few hundred on that printer. It was, when you told me about it, it was like, you were spending how much on a printer, Michael? Really? The printing is the costumes, amazing, right? Emmys, they got them all. I don't know if they won, but they were nominated for them.
Right, they got all the nominations.
Yeah, so that's what really counts. So let's jump into a couple of things, and that's going to be, well, 3 things, like you said earlier: the favorite scene, the favorite character, and let's go over the most memorable lines from the show. So we're going to start with personally my favorite scene, and that's when we learn of the conflict. Well, we learn why there is such deep conflict between the elves and the men, and what drives the distrust, and why that's there.
This is a pillar, right, of all great shows. You got to have that tension. Got to explain the tension. Where does it come
from? Why would the Numenoreans actually help the elves? Like, you have to set this up, and so they do it in perhaps the most expert way, again, by not looking backwards, but by looking forwards, by looking to our time. What influences us here in our world the most? And I'm going to go through this kind of line by line. And so here's the first part of that scene.
Mate attacks 4 guildsmen, and Miriel has her up for tea.
Probably she called the elf in to punish her.
Or to ask her for orders.
Yeah, so we learn right away that there's this tension between the elves and them, right? They know that the elf and her mate, that's what he says. It's a little hard to understand right there, but he says her mate came in and attacked, right? So there's immediately this tension. They set that up right away, done incredibly well. That writing is tremendous. Let's keep going.
And while the elf whispers poison in our queen's ear, who's speaking for us?
Right. And that harkens back to, like, sort of our time, like, who's speaking for us here in our world? And we always look for those leaders that are speaking for us. And these elves, they don't trust Miriel. They see them talking to Galadriel. So we not only have the tension between the elves and the men that's starting to build, but between the citizens of Numenor and their royalty. They don't find them worth their time, right? If they're going to give elves all this power, then why would they trust their royalty?
Elf ships on our shore. Elf workers. taking your trades.
Right. And what is more real than that? What is more real than the elf workers taking your trades? I mean, this is the political drive of almost this election right now, is like, what's most important? It's those immigrants coming in, taking all of our jobs here. And so when the elves come in, when they see that one super powerful 5'4" elf come in, and obviously she's there to take their jobs because she's wearing the trade, you know, jerk. Okay, but she's there to take their jobs, and they see that one elf, and that's all that they need. That's all that they need, because they know the evil of elves. They've seen them for thousands of years, maybe tens of thousands of years in Numenor already. I think that's what Tolkien wrote. So the elves taking their jobs. It's important. All right, taking their trades. It's not really their jobs, right? Their trades. So I guess that would be butchering. That would be metalworking. That would be livery stuff, right? That would be scribes. All the elves are going to come in and do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I found the writing here awesome, because it's showing how perceptive this man is, that he just, from one example.
Totally.
Of an elven woman, he can see how it's going to go. He can see that, you know, this is the end for tradesmen on Numenor. And yeah. I mean, like, what foresight.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's keep going.
Workers who don't sleep.
Don't sleep.
Don't tire.
Don't tire.
Don't age.
Like, how can you compete with that? Right? So this...
I say the queen's either blind or an elf lover.
So imagine going up against a workforce that doesn't sleep, that doesn't tire, that doesn't age. Of course, they're going to hire elves, right? Like, every single industry is going to hire an elf. Why would they hire a human?
Elves are like the AI of you know, Middle
Earth. Wow, that is insightful.
I mean,
wow. Hold on.
It wasn't me. Like, the Rings of Power, they led me right to it.
That's... Yeah, the elves are like the AI, right? They're the ones that, and they will probably, elves. Yeah, they'll
never
probably
sleep. Yep. Never eat. Yep.
Wow. It strikes me that, you know, this is what we're up against here in our world with these immigrants that come in and they don't sleep and they don't eat either. And we know where they're going to take our jobs here. That's really what they're talking about.
It is so, kind of a combination, right? They're
illegal
AI is what this basically
illegal
is.
AI. The elves are illegal AI. That's
seems
that's
right.
Deep. That's deep. All right, let's finish this scene off.
Just like her father. Elf lover.
Right. There's nothing worse in the world than to be called elf lover. I can't
count the times since this episode that I've just found myself sort of waking up and chanting elf lover.
Elf lover. Oh, it's so sad. So it reminds me of all those scenes we see the MAGA lovers here, that they go to the Home Depot and they start chanting immigrant lover. That's all, you know, immigrant lover. And when you see those scenes on Twitter and TikTok, it really hits me here. And to see that represented now in Middle Earth is so powerful. It strikes me to the core that we need to be aware. And so now we have this tension. We have this utter tension between men and elves that are set up, that the elves are coming not just to defeat them, but to actually, you know, grind them under the heel of their economy, right? They're going to take over. They're not just going to like destroy it. No, it's like they're insidious. They're coming in. They're just going to take their jobs and push them all out. There'll be nobody left to vote for their queen.
This is just prophetic. That scene was so prophetic of our modern world. It's just,
yeah. I mean, yeah. Once that scene hit, I was all in on the show.
Geniuses.
Because I knew that it was speaking to me, and it wasn't just some old white guy writing it anymore. It was actually a part of the world that we live in. And when we watch TV and we read books, all we want is to be reminded of all the problems of our world and how we need to deal with them. And so when I saw that in Rings of Power, I thought, wow, what great writers, what great showrunners, what great actors. What a great way to make us buy into the show by relating it to the problems of our world. It was tremendous. It was tremendous. Some that's of that, Michael.
That's what I'm looking for from when I want a Tolkien show.
Me too.
I want all the stuff that I'm getting to my news. I want it to match. I want go to Tolkien or, you know, Rings of Power, which is, let's admit it, might be slightly better than Tolkien.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe improve upon.
Okay. Like, yeah. Look, I'm not disagreeing.
Tolkien's great. Everyone can be improved on.
Right.
So.
Right. Right. No, I mean, he said that people should, you know, start playing with. I think he mentioned that somewhere where other writers should change what he wrote. I think we're his almost verbatim.
Other hands and minds.
I don't know.
Politics. I don't know.
Yeah, change it. Do something better with my stuff because, you know, as we grow as a society, we only get better. Things never get worse. It is a push toward the future that is, you know, that's what Star Trek is, right? We will get there eventually, and everything, you know, this year is better than last year because as humanity, we only get better. We grow in our love of the human. And if all we focus on is the economics and politics of things, then we will always get better.
If Tolkien didn't say that, he should have.
So he should have. Absolutely. 100%. Well, all right. That was
my favorite, not as good as yours.
Okay.
But as everyone knows, you know, one of the things that's often said about Tolkien is that he wasn't just writing a fantasy story. He was making a mythology. And so there's so many mythological elements to Tolkien. And I have to say that of all of the entirety of the first season, I think it was episode 5, had my favorite moment, which was this piece of mythology. And what I love here is that the Rings of Power writers, they're showing their real genius because they don't just take the world that Tolkien created and put a great story in there with great actors and themes and bringing it back, like you said, to our world today, you know, one-to-one connections. That's great. But they also took a hand on the mythological elements. And frankly, you know, we know a lot, if you read the Silmarillion, as we have and gone through it, you know that the Silmarils are a major part of Tolkien's histories and mythology. But clearly, the writers of Rings of Power saw that there was probably some things that could have been improved on. So they took their hand at mythology. And so in episode 5, we have what the king Gil-galad calls the Song of the Roots of Hithalgir, might have mispronounced that. Hithalgir.
It doesn't. Anyway, the language doesn't really matter.
Whatever. It's just confusing. Elvish is a confusing language.
Yeah.
Says some gobbledygook. But anyway, he has Elrond recount this mythology. And it's awesome because very subtly the writers, the Rings of Power, change elements of what Tolkien had probably fairly crudely written down. And so we actually find out that in this, you know, in Rings of Power, that there's, you know, a Silmaril that maybe was unaccounted for, or perhaps there was one of the Silmarils that, you know, were accounted for, but somehow it ended up in this different part of the world, 1,000 miles away.
And it doesn't matter. Again, they're allowed to rewrite whatever they want.
That's the power of imagination, right? So they retell this tale, and this is going to explain to us from the Silmaril, from the idea of the Silmaril, fourth Silmaril out of the three or something. And they're going to explain how Mithril comes about, this wondrous metal that Tolkien has as part of his legendarium.
Let me know when you're ready. I want me to show you.
We're going to start hearing about this mythological tale, and we'll stop it at different points, and I'll talk about just the brilliance of the elements they put in.
Here we go.
On one side fought an elven warrior. The heart is pure as Manwë.
What do you think about that? A great line. With the heart as pure as Manwë.
Okay, so this is awesome. So, and right before this scene, we can only take certain cuts because we don't want to get dinged for copyright.
But
they make clear, Elrond makes clear that this is a battle that occurred in the Misty Mountains. Now, we all may be thinking to ourselves, the Silmarils, the history of the Silmarils, it took place in Beleriand, which is, you know, under the ocean, thousands of miles away. That's where the Rossetti fighting between elf warriors and Balrogs. And the Silmarils spent their time. But no, we have to just like open your mind and understand that this is a better story. And in this, the elf warriors here fighting on the Misty Mountains over a Silmaril that's in a tree. Because, I mean, look, if you're going to hide a Silmaril, seems like a good place.
Right. Well, and remember, there was the light of the tree. So obviously, where do you want to put the light of the Silmaril?
In a tree.
All right.
Seems to make sense.
Poured all his light into the tree to protect it.
Right.
The other, a Balrog.
Okay. Look, I know that in Tolkien, we don't really have a vision of elves like a big batteries pouring their light into things. I understand that's not really a Tolkien, but I mean, let's be real. We've all played video games. Isn't this a much better idea?
Mm-hmm.
If the good people can actually have light that comes out of them, they can pour into things. Right. And then we're about to see the bad guys can have darkness they pour out of them, like dark battery things.
Right. It's when you think about it, it's how George Lucas improved on Lord of the Rings by calling it the light side of the Force. Right.
There you go. There you go.
We're essentially, like I said, we get better as time progresses. And so we're taking from other things too. And so just the light side of magic here. This is what he's doing. He's pouring his light, the light side of the Force of the elves into it.
Pours his light into this tree, Silmaril to the top.
Here we go.
Okay,
go ahead. Should I keep playing?
I'm just saying, you may ask yourself as you're watching the scene, why would they keep a Silmaril at the top of a tree? Why would they be fighting by pouring their light into a tree? And I would just say, look, go with it. This is the imagination. This is the writing of a superior mind here. So let's go.
All right.
Of Morgoth. Channeled all his hatred into the tree to destroy it.
Now, why do you think a Balrog would hate a tree? Because he channeled all of his hatred into the tree.
Yep. I mean, look, this is clearly Tolkien making an ecological statement. So this is, this is the Rings of Power writers improving on Tolkien's. Like Tolkien, like he loved trees. We have the Ents and we have the two trees. Like clearly, so the Rings of Power writers are just doing what they do best, which is they take what Tolkien wrote and they elevate it to the next level. So here we have evil. And what does it want to do more than anything else? Does it want to attack the elf in front of it? No, it wants to kill the tree.
Oh man,
which has the Silmaril. So I mean, I guess would get the Silmaril out. I don't know, whatever. So he the Balrog's gonna, I mean, that, and then the elf is like, I'm gonna protect the tree. I'm like super Greenpeace or white peace.
Totally.
Wait, not white. Nope, not white. Super light
elf peace.
Light peace.
Okay, well let's keep going.
It's that dew unending lightning ensnared the tree.
Okay.
Bam.
Stop there. All right. So this is genius. Okay, look.
Lightning hits the tree.
Before Tolkien lived, of course, we have one of the great authors of literature, or at least one of the great stories in literature of the 19th century, Frankenstein. Mm. Okay? And in Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the life of the monster, Frankenstein's monster, is able to come about because of lightning. Like, this is such a classic move. This is like, and so the Rings of Power writers, look, they see Tolkien's work and they love it, but they realize it could be a bit better. And so let's just take a little lightning, you know, Frankenstein style. Let's throw it in the mix. So you got light from the elf and darkness from the Balrog and lightning. And as everyone knows, if that's the kind of combination, the magical formula, you're going to get something really awesome like Mithril. And that's what happens.
Forging of their conflict.
Mithril, it's like lightning strikes into the stone. It's so, I mean, and the beauty of this scene too, right? It looks like the greatest video game you've ever seen.
Probably better.
Probably better than one from like 2020. But it was amazing. It looked so good. And that Mithril going down. Let's keep following the scene here. If you want me to stop, let me know.
A power as pure and light, as good, as strong and unyielding as evil.
Look, everyone knows that of all the things in the world that are like unyielding, it's evil that's the most unyielding.
Yeah.
Like, and everyone knows that purity and light is good, like good. So, I mean, look, this is perfect. It's like, it's all the immaterial qualities that Tolkien would have, of course, agreed with, and then they're put into a material thing. And Gil-galad is about to say, like, the trapped light of the Silmarils. So this is what happens to the light of the Silmarils. Like, the idea, and frankly, let's remember, Tolkien had one of the Silmarils end up on the brow of Eärendil, end up in the stars. It's this perpetual light shining down. Kind of boring. Mm-hmm. Look, how much better if the light of the Silmarils instead were trapped in a metal in the bottom of a mountain? And that's, I mean, genius.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's, the Silmaril is destroyed. I mean, I think so, right? Like, it's far better. If this is the third Silmaril, it's far better than, like, what, being thrown into an ocean? Like, what? Who does that?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this, give it a reason. Like, if you don't have a purpose for anything, like, there was no reason for him to throw it in the ocean. Look, it was just sort of a random thing that one of those elf guy, Sons of Fea something did.
Yeah, and far look, better. Look, everyone knows, like, underground, you know, inside of a mountain, way more interesting than at the bottom of the ocean. Like, mm-hmm. it's not like there's ever been books written about the ocean is boring. Look, yeah. it's not, there's nothing there.
We've found out everything we know about the ocean. There's no more. Okay.
So I love this. This is, and this is genius. And you know, here we are. So they're showing their mythological chops. They can take what Tolkien gave them, probably, you know, B+ grade stuff, and they can raise it up and bring it to a new
level. You're pretty generous with that B+, but
I like Tolkien, so you know, B+ sometimes. Right.
You know what what I love about the scene is that it encapsulates what Tolkien said in that fairy essay he did, where he talks about how your imagination, he talks about how your imagination on fairy dust is so much better than anything else that's done. That, and here they're using their imagination, so they're taking that idea that imagination is more powerful than anything else and using it to give us something that's more powerful, a more powerful TV show than has ever been put on screen.
Right. You know, we're not worthy. That's what I got to say.
Wonderful. All right, let's get into then. These are two favorite scenes. Let's get into our two favorite characters. Why don't you kick off, Michael? Because mine is perhaps it's a little more central to the show. But
okay, yours is all right. Yeah. So I'm when I was thinking about, you know, who is my favorite character from Rings of Power. There are a lot of choices. Because there's so many good characters. I mean, it's hard to think of a bad one, actually, a poor choice. I almost chose that guy from the marketplace that you were talking about, but then I realized I couldn't remember his name, so probably not the best choice. But I was going through the characters, and I realized I have to give it up for the leader of probably the best adaptation of, I know we're not supposed to say it, the best adaptation of Hobbits. That you know, Rings of Power did. We're technically supposed to call him Harfoot, so yeah, I get it. There we go. So the leader of now the reimagined Hobbits in this, you know, Harfoot in this in Rings of Power are they're kind of cool because Tolkien envisioned this small people that don't like to be seen, and they love the simple things of life, and they stay away from the big folk, and they, you know, in the Shire and everything. But honestly, I always thought reading Tolkien, it's kind of, you know, it's a little stupid. I know people. Here's why. Look, bear with me. If you are a race of people that doesn't like to be seen, why on earth would you have a culture that stays in the same place? Like, that's just kind of silly.
Right.
So instead, the Rings of Power writers, they took the Hobbits and they made them like what really Tolkien should have written, which is, here's a people that are nomadic. So they move about, so they can, they can hide and they can stay away from the big folks. This is great. So the head of the tribe of Harfoots, his name is Sadok. And, this is him right here. In like full regalia, it's awesome. I love this sort of religious regalia that he has. It's inspiring. Mm-hmm. I kind of want like them to lean in a little more into this religion because this might be something that attracts me. I'm like, what do they believe? This is awesome. Something to do with birds' nests, but anyway, he is not my favorite character because of that. Like, you know, awesome.
No, that's reason enough.
Cost me aside. I'm gonna. There's so many things to pick about his character, which I find inspiring, but I'm going to focus on three. So for the three things that I chose, reasons that I chose that Sadok was my favorite character. He's the leader of this tribe of nomadic hobbits, and they're moving continuously. And you know what I really like about the way they wrote his character is that Sadok, unlike a lot of leaders who are afraid to make the hard choices in life, Sadok does not shy away from the hard choices. He does what it takes to lead his people. And let me give you a couple examples. So in the movie, in the show, you know, one of the rules about this Hobbit culture is you're always on the move, and you know, they stick together and they're out for each other unless, and this is, you know, a reality of their world unless you're a little slower than the rest of them. And you get then you get left behind and you die. And, you know, that's harsh. But as a leader of this tribe, he has to uphold these rules and make sure that, you know, their society congeals. It has that structure, which is so necessary, where they just and so he is willing to leave behind, you know, the people of his tribe who are just a little slower, or maybe their cart gets breaks a wheel or something, and they're left behind. Like that's harsh. That's justice. That's like fair, harsh but fair. That's what I call it. But you know, it's really interesting because a good leader has to both have justice and mercy, right? So there isn't. It isn't just that just side of him that we see. We also see that in as they're on the trail, Sadok is their leader who brings out the stories to them at night that they can and little ditties and poems where they can talk about those hobbits they've had to leave behind, and they can kind of, you know, lift their hearts. So he's got like the justice side and the mercy side. So he's being merciful to his people by you know, lifting them up and giving them something to laugh about, like, you know, the hobbit's weight or how slow they were or something like that, you know. And that humor and mirth that he brings to the, like, core part of hobbit culture. And just really, really shows his
I mean, I'm sure you would have picked, if you could have, all the Harfeet, the hobbits.
Sure.
If you could have, but you have to pick the leader, the one who they're, and as you say, you know, it is sad that at the end when he died.
Well, you can't take that from me. Like, that's my last point.
Go for it.
All right, sorry. But no, look, for me, and maybe you got something else to say about this, but this his role, the reason that he's my favorite character is because in the end, at the end of the season one, Rings of Power, by the way, spoiler alert, so anyone that hasn't seen Rings of Power.
What are you talking about?
By now, I know, I don't even know why
250 million people watched it.
Why would you be watching this show? I mean, maybe you're part of the 63% that never finished, but if that's the case, then shame on you. And you know, spoiler. Yeah. So at the end, Sadok sadly is killed, and he's killed by some, you know, folk of dubious gender, which is another nod to Rings of Power for its diversity, equity, and inclusion, because that is what we want in our fantasy shows about Tolkien. And so there, you know, in one of the final episodes, he's killed and he dies, and it does take him a while to die from a mortal wound. Like, you know, there's a lot of talking and such, but in the end, he does what I think the best leader of a tribe in his position would do, which is he, by his death, frees the various other female hobbits from the patriarchy of the tribe. Wow. You know, he's the patriarchy. He's the ruler, and he's letting them go free. He's giving them that empowerment, and he's just handing it over to them because they can take the reins and they can rule and they whatever it is they want to do. I mean, that they're free to do whatever, leave or get left behind or whatever they want. But by like the ultimate barrier and the ultimate sacrifice are one and the same. He kills himself or lets himself die so that he could, you know, free them from that overarching patriarchal structure. Genius. Wonderful work.
That gives his story arc such impact, right? Yep. You realize in the beginning that he's the leader, and maybe you're not questioning as much as you should, but by the end you realize, oh yeah, the patriarch needs to be gotten rid of. We need to throw that out with the bathwater. So that alone. And then I also like it in his final scene, how when he passes, right? I think he takes a knife, something to the gut. A knife to the gut. And so, but he sits down and instead of like saying, you know, I want to spend time with my family, I want to watch the sunrise. And that again, that's like the earth is what's important. The world around us, like, let's remember that more than let's remember the people around us, because people were just, you know, we're parasites on the earth, even all of us. So let's remember, let's put ourselves in that position of like, we are small and tiny and inconsequential in this world, that where the world and the climate and the impact that we have on it is so much more important.
It's so true. He's just like, I mean, he's showing what's important. And you know, that gives I didn't even think that's wonderful that you said that, because it gives me a new perspective on the whole leaving things behind, you know, leaving the folks behind, because look, what's more important, like when you, if you have a society like they do that he leads and you're leaving people behind, you're doing the world a favor, right? Because since we're all parasites, then you're 100%. you're just in this continuous process of, you know, abandoning your own people to return to the earth and freeing the earth from their influence. I mean, look, this is just a beautiful society. I feel like I should be a Harfoot. Don't we all? Yeah. So anyway,
female Harfoot, not the male. You'd rather be a female Harfoot. But I
probably would. Yeah. I mean, especially at the end.
Yeah. Absolutely. 100%. All right. That was a great choice. I don't know if I can top this, but I have to. This is the character that most defines the series, both for the choices made, for how the writers took a bland, boring, lifeless character that we'd seen before and changed it into a courageous, relational, young warrior that that clearly we all love. And that, of course, everybody, that, of course, is Galadriel. And I think that her impact on the show can't be measured by just people who watch it. Right. I mean, it's measured by how much they changed her from who we know, because as we said before, we move forward, we get better. And so the four things about her that's,
by the way, can I just say before the board, thank you for choosing a woman, because one thing I felt bad about was I choose a man. I mean, he was a man that removed himself as the patriarch, so that was good. But I mean, Galadriel,
how can you? Yes.
I mean, right. Like my heart is a flutter every time she came on screen. It was amazing.
It's she bows to no one. Let's put it that way.
There she bows to no one. There you go.
Especially in this here. And there are four things that set her apart from the rest of the characters. And that's one, that she's now young, right? She's not this old, boring, bland, shining elf that we saw in Peter Jackson's film who really just doesn't do anything. I mean, does she have any impact on the hobbits at all? I don't think so. Like, she barely talks with them.
Yeah, I mean, she makes it more boring. That's the impact.
For sure. So, and so now we see that she's young, right? She's just like Tolkien wanted her to be brash. I think so, at least. Like, she was supposed to be an Amazon, I think. Or I think that's what
I mean,
Tolkien
like wrote. Amazons wish they were like her. This is
100%. Who wouldn't want to be like a 5'4 elf of warrior kind? So she's young, she's brash, she's abrasive. And we can tell, right, she has to grow still. She has so much to learn. I think she's like at least 100 years old right now. Maybe more? Is it more? Maybe more. But anyway, she's much younger than she is in what we saw in Peter Jackson's movies, which, you know, I don't know how many people really like those anymore. So that was a great thing for us to kind of attach to. Is like, she's like the rest of us. She's still growing. She's young, and she needs to, you know, she needs to be less of a hothead in a way. What a wonderful way of us to make her more approachable.
One of the things that I have to admit, I did not enjoy from so much from the Rings of Power writers, and they did so much right, but there was an overtone as we moved through the episodes that we should be a little bit, you know, a little bit down or a little bit critical of her loss of temper and how she was abrasive. And I just thought it's probably uncalled for because, look, this is Galadriel. She's been around since the First Age. Like, really arrogance if you actually are better than everyone else? That's what I say. So I just think we should have given her the recognition and enough of this judgment about her
first
negative quality. So first anyway, carry on.
But one thing she has learned, right? Is how she's a warrior now. She is able to defeat anything that comes her way. Like, there we go, this cave troll, right? There is nothing that she can't do better than the men around her. And let's be honest, she was at least as good as Legolas was in the films for Peter Jackson, right? Legolas, what, he ran down an Olfon, or ran up an Olfon's back and like killed it and stuff, and then slid down its trunk, and he ran up like falling stones in The Hobbit. But if you feel that Galadriel can't do that stuff, we know that there's only one reason why you would think that that a woman can't do what a man like Legolas would do. And that is your sexism and misogyny. So if you don't like Galadriel, like we know, I instantly know the reason why. There's nothing you have to say, because if you like Legolas and you dislike Galadriel here in the Rings of Power, can you think of a reason why? That's got to be the only reason.
All I have to say is Tolkien's not for you, obviously. I'm like, Rings of Power is not for you, which is, you know, taking Tolkien to 11. You know, this is just not for you. So if you're that kind of misogynist, please leave. We don't want your business. Not that we make any money, but you know, we just still want your business. Right. And I have to say, shout out to another podcast that I heard a while back on this, that's a little known podcaster, Gary from Nerdrotic, and he has this great he points out.
Never heard of him.
Maybe I'll be able to send you a link if he hasn't shut his channel down. But you know, he points out, like, he has this dub over with Galadriel from Peter Jackson's films, where she's talking and she's rightly trying to point out to everyone how she killed an ice troll in less than 10 seconds. Once she started fighting, of course, because, you know, she had to cull the weak from her own band. But
here's the thing. They made her, and clearly rightfully so, the commander of the Northern armies. And so she's commanding all six people, and she's doing a wonderful job, because what does she do? Like, their entire Northern army that's with her of all six people can't defeat this troll. But all she needs is those 10 seconds. And she's a warrior that cannot be trifled with. And so, in lieu of that, right, I don't even know if the Numenoreans knew that, but she trains the entire Numenorean army too. She actually goes in, and I mean, the army, I think, is like double the size of the Elven army, at least. So we're looking at so many people in the army, and she trains them. And
double digits.
Right. And she teaches them, you don't use strength. You only use your feet. I think something like that, which is clearly more important when you fight. Strength doesn't matter at all. I mean, she's got courage. That's more than strength. And that's one of her other most important parts I'll get to in a second. And so this courage is what drives her forward. And that's what makes her able to beat a cave troll that's probably, you know, four times her size, maybe five ish.
In less than 10 seconds.
So obviously, great warrior. Number three is that courage that she exemplifies. She comes off as somebody who will not be trifled with.
Very.
And we learned that. Number one, we talked about it, the cave troll. Number two, when she's sent to Numenor, what does she do? Does she just does she just sit there and go on the boat? No. When she approaches Numenor, right, her courage takes over, and she jumps off the ship in the middle of the ocean, thousands of miles from shore. I mean, if that doesn't take courage, nothing does.
Look, Michael Phelps got nothing. Like, she could swim an ocean, okay?
100%.
This is what we should all aspire to. I mean, I can't because I'm a man, but all women should aspire to this. She's the role model.
It's a leap of faith in no uncertain terms. And that courage drives her forward, because she knows who she is and the power that she has within herself to swim to shore. But then we come to, okay, and you know, she does other courageous things I'm not going to get into. I think that step alone, and she's able to defeat when she gets out of jail on her own in the Numenor. She does a great job there. She defeats the orcs on her own, pretty much, with Bronwyn and Arendir, right on that side there. She's there. She's taking over, and she's making sure that everybody's safe. Right? She has the courage to do the things that other people would. She drives the Numenoreans in order to go over the seas. Like, her courage pushes them to create their vast army, their vast sailing vessels, all six of them ish, and to go overseas and support. At least three of them to go overseas and support that small town that is super meaningful, because there's a big dam nearby that is protecting them from.
You can't forget, right after that, she defeats a volcano, right? Because she stands up to that pyroclastic blast, like right in the face. Nobody else. That's that's like everybody else turned to cinders and runs screaming. She doesn't, she's not scared. The courage, she has the courage to face the volcano. So, right. I mean, look, is it, if that is not the face of bravery,
the face of courage.
I mean, a little bit of nacho bravery.
If that doesn't make you catch your breath just a little bit and lick your fingers, then I don't know what does. All right. So the fourth thing that is super important is the relationships.
I mean, I have my bravery and you have your bravery, but this is nacho bravery.
Not at all. All right. The fourth thing that she does are the relationships that were established here. And I think the first one I want to talk about goes back to her jumping off the boat and meeting Halbrand, perhaps the greatest new character. Well, they,
Halbro, right?
Halbro, yeah, the greatest dude in Middle Earth.
Right.
That they, these showrunners, these writers recreated out of Sauron, right? Who doesn't want to see essentially Aragorn? Sauron is Aragorn. And so they made this wonderful character of Halbrand, but her relationship with him, it evolves into, you know, there's some love going on there. There's some real connection that they have until the very end when, bam, we're like, we're broken out of that relationship that they have because we find out that he's Sauron. Nobody knew. I mean, did anybody know he was Sauron? Nobody had a clue.
I think nobody in the world. I just stared at the screen for like 5 hours after that.
I felt floored. The same way here as I did when I saw The Sixth Sense for the first time or The Matrix, where all of a sudden the whole world looks different to me. That's Sauron.
I was convinced
that love is gone.
They had fooled me. I thought for sure that the stranger was Sauron. Like that was, it was so, it was genius. Yeah. They even had his own little cabal of people who also thought they were fooled too. They thought he was Sauron. Yeah. So, I mean, look, this was genius writing right here.
Yeah. Yeah. They brought the relationship and then just tore it apart, and that tore our hearts apart. Oh. The second relationship I think that we need to look at is her relationship with Elrond and how she's the warrior, right? We are again leaning into what we know is better and right in today's world where the woman is the warrior and the men are the politician architects, the ones who stay home. And so what they did is they established the world that should be. And not the world that is, in a way. They're making it better for us. And so the relationship between Elrond and Galadriel is a reversal because we know that that's better. And I feel like that they really leaned into that. They made Elrond, you know, a little more soyish. I mean, a little better.
Look, I was
convinced. Women love that anyway.
And Elrond, I was sure he was vegan.
All right. So the last relationship that I think maybe even more than her relationship with Halbrand that defines the series is her relationship with Muriel. Because what they've done is they've set up that the most powerful relationship is the female to female relationship. And it's not, and it's a diverse relationship. And I think when we lean into that diversity of being just women, you know, because what is more diverse than just women, right? That is diversity at its core. When you only have women, That's the kind of relationship that drives the world forward. And so they have, they see eye to eye, and finally she's able to convince Muriel that we've got to go overseas and we've got to save the people. And so it's their relationship that's really driving this female to female diverse relationship is driving the plot forward. Without their input, without them making these decisions for Galadriel, for destroying the orcs, I mean, she was there too late and but you know, and then she saves Halbrand and then she's essentially the one who's taking Halbrand, right? All these decisions, they drive the plot forward, but who's doing it? It's the two women, the diverse,
as it should be,
homogeneous women are doing it. And I think that's, so these relationships are what really endear her to us. So anyway, that's, I mean, who's going to argue with Galadriel and Sadok as the best characters in all of television in the last two decades, at least?
Bigots. That's all I can think of. Bigots,
misogynists, haters.
Yep.
Yeah. They're all there.
That's it.
All right, guys, if you think differently, please put them in, like, if there's a character that you like better, put it below.
Let us know.
Like, let us know in the comments, man. We'll respond. We'll take it in. But if there's a character that's better than Galadriel, that's better than Sadok, I doubt it. But you know what? I mean, aren't all the characters in Rings of Power better than everything else? So who's going to argue?
But, hey, look, this is the internet. you're free to be as wrong as you like. Go ahead and post it, and we'll tell you why you're wrong.
Yeah, 100%. We'll do that easy peasy. All right, guys, we'll go into the last part of this, which is we're going to talk about the best and most impactful lines from The Rings of Power. So the first line we're going to talk about is from Elendil. And in fact, I believe this line was from the trailer that came out in the summer of 2022.
I love this line.
It's been so long since the show came out. It feels like it was 6 years ago. This line is this: the past is dead. We either move forward or we die with it. I think that's verbatim from Tolkien in The Silmarillion, what Elendil said to somebody.
Or it should have been.
And it says, like, nothing behind us matters. Everything behind us is crap, right? Just like those swords that the hobbits got in the Lord of the Rings. They were crap. They didn't... Anyway, Everything in the past shouldn't take precedence over anything else. And so that's what they're saying. It's like, move forward. Don't worry about what's in the past. Just worry about the future and where you want to go. You know, worry about the world that we're going to create, not about the world that we're in. Because that's the past.
It's really nice to see progressive Numenoreans.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like, and progressive elves. Like, it's just wonderful to see finally a vision of Tolkien where people just have their eyes fixed on the future and they don't care about what's gone before and they don't care about it. Like, it's just all about what's here and now in front of me, and whatever was in the past, dead.
Yeah. Recreate the world that you want. The second line is perhaps, I mean, there is nothing more profound than this. I have read the Bible. I've read the Quran. I've read all versions of the Talmud, and nothing is more impactful in my life than this statement. Do you know why a ship floats and a stone cannot? Because the stone sees only downward. The darkness of the water, the darkness of the water, is vast and irresistible. The ship feels the darkness as well, striving moment by moment to master her and pull her under. But the ship has a secret. For unlike the stone, her gaze is not downward, but up, fixed upon the light that guides her, whispering of grander things than darkness ever knew.
Look,
I mean, it's the way I learned to swim. Look up, don't look down.
Also, it's why I hate rocks. They could only look down. They're just,
it's
boring. Like when all the rocks, all the things that go down, I mean, everything from the stones that are at the bottom of the ocean, which nobody cares about because the ocean is boring, to the rocks and stones at the bottom of a mountain, except the mithril, which, everything that is rock related only looks down. It's a
life maxim that if you just remember this: look up, don't look down, and you won't sink in water.
Right.
There's no way you won't succeed.
Yeah, I almost drowned at one point when I was 14 years old, and I was tangled up in seaweed, and I was out snorkeling with my family, and I got a weight belt on and all this stuff, and I was going down. I barely survived. If I had just known this lesson, that all I had to do to survive was look up,
you would have been perfectly fine. You would have floated right to the top.
I would not have, like, the trauma I got from that incident, like, all my life would have been so many therapy bills would have been saved by that.
You know, I think about this this phrase, and I think it's so it's pregnant with meaning, like with octuplets. Right? But I guess it just never gives birth. But it's so pregnant with meaning.
It could be, anything could be pregnant.
Anything. Right. Anything at all. Rocks that look down.
I mean,
stillbirths,
right? Because they end up at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, but it's pregnant with meaning. It hasn't given birth. Okay, next line. A dog may bark at the moon, but he cannot bring it down. By Durin.
I still haven't figured out what that means. Like, it's so deep that I'm just, a dog's barking at the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, why? Why are they barking?
The depth. I feel like that they are on such a level above us that why even try to understand it?
I feel like I'm because a little bit of that stone from the previous line. I'm like, yeah, maybe I can look up a little bit. No, I keep looking up. No, maybe I can look up.
But isn't that what makes the show great? Is like we can keep musing on these phrases that are so deep, and we can come up maybe one day with a meaning for them. Maybe.
Okay. I mean, maybe season two,
they're going to reveal in season two. Why he can't bring it down?
I hope they bring the dog back that's barking at the moon in season two.
Me too. Yeah, maybe he'll bring it down. Next line. This comes from, I think, it's Bronwyn.
Okay.
And this line, I think it's a line that they came up all on their own, is beautiful, and has again, deep meaning. In the end, this shadow is but a small and passing thing. There is light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Find the light, and the shadow will not find you. I mean, can you imagine being the person who came up with that line and how profound that is?
It's chills.
And like that line can never be copied by anyone. It's so good. Nobody would ever like dare to copy a line that has such meaning.
I think that episode's going to live as like the top of what Tolkien could have been.
Could have written. He could have done that.
Could have, but I mean, he started, gave us a little world and stuff, but to have a line like that at the end, like just so
profound.
I wish
he would have done it. It would have made the Lord of the Rings better if he would have put that line in it. He should have done it. I mean, and I've read Lord of the Rings at least once, so I think like I would have known if
that's if like half a time more than I have. So
yeah, awesome. I'm so glad that they wrote that line again. The respect for the writers that they come up with this stuff on their own is peak level.
They should be
peak
proud
level
of themselves.
Education here. Yeah. Yep, all right. Next line. Where there is love, it is truly. Let me get this right because it's so good. Where there is love, it is never truly dark. Because like we learned, love and goodness are light earlier, right? They established that with the Mithril, that there is a light and goodness come together. So where there is love, which is good, it can't be dark. That's what they're saying. That's what Elrond.
But since the Mithril is made of darkness too, then where there's Mithril, there can't be love. Which might explain why Disa and her husband had such marital troubles, besides his misogyny, of course. But
yeah,
I never thought about that. That's it's the Mithril, the darkness in the Mithril can't be love. Okay, got it. Like another one of those connectors that.
Yeah, I mean, you know why they have marital troubles? It's because Durin's the king. He's going to be the king, and Disa really should be in that role. And we know that's the right thing to do, and he's not doing it. That's where all the trouble comes from.
Maybe he'll get there in season two. Maybe.
Yeah, and for some reason, he still loves her, and she still loves him. I don't get it, but it's profound. It's profound that love and goodness are light, and it casts out the dark shadows in Khazad Dûm. Because it would, you know, if everybody just loved in Khazad Dûm, they wouldn't need to put any flames on sconces anywhere. It would just be light all the time.
If they just opened their hearts. But you know, dwarves, most of them just look like men, and that's I think that's their problem.
Yeah. All right. Last line, and we're gonna stick with the dwarves here. And you know, it's a little funny, but man, it's profound. It's give me the meat and give it to me raw. Yeah, right? It gives you the shivers. And the reason that I find it so, like it stuck with me, this was at the very end of the season, and it stuck with me, is that when you burn meat, right, it becomes smaller, so you're not getting everything that the meat has. And you probably already cut it up, so it's in smaller pieces. So when it's raw, it's not real. It's probably not cut up. It's probably straight from the cow, straight from the bull, straight from the rabbit, the coney. And so this line of "Give me the meat and give it to me raw." Right? What a profound way of saying, like, tell me everything you know. And I've started using that in my interactions in my interactions with my wife. Where I just say, give me the meat and give it to me raw when I need information. That's all she needs to hear. And when I say that, boom, like we're on the same page. Give me the meat, give it to me raw.
That is, that's really, really deep. I never, ever would have thought of that. but I do have to say, the one thing that, like, when I hear that line, what I recognize is that they're trying to show us what deep friends you know, Durin and Elrond are. And as we talked about earlier in this episode, you know, we know Elrond's a vegan. So when Durin is asking him to give him the meat and give it to him raw, he's lifting the burden of the meat that's been foisted upon his friend. And he's just taking it to himself because he loves his friend so much. So, I mean, like, that's all I got out of it was like the vegan
dynamic. No, that's a good point.
What a friend. What a friend.
Right. And you notice it's not the elves saying it. It is the dwarves, because the elves are the light. They're the good. And so they would never eat meat raw.
Dwarves live in darkness. So, you know, if you're going to have to put meat somewhere, give it to the dwarves.
Give it to the dwarves. Give it to them raw. Wow. What an episode. I feel like, man, I just want to go back and watch all 10 hours of the show again.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it tonight. Yeah. I'm not even going to sleep.
Straight through. Yeah. Like how would anybody ever fall asleep during this show? It is action packed with the most amazing vocabulary and phrases and lines put to the small screen. I just like you'd never fall asleep. All right, everybody.
Yeah, no show deserves the small screen more than this one.
We're going to jump into our extended edition. We're going to talk about why we did this episode and the things that we truly love and dissect a little bit more into what makes the Rings of Power tick-ish.
Right, and especially why it took us so long to do this episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we should have done it a long time ago.
Tick, tick.
Tick, tick. All right, so if you want to become a member and hear that, go to theonering.com/member. It's free for the first month, $4 a month after that, or to go to theonering.com/Patreon, and you can use your Patreon account where it's a buck more at $5 because Patreon takes their pound of flesh. And we'll see you in Discord where you can comment on this wonderful, wonderful show. So we'll see you on the other side.
Which we can only afford to do once a year. So
once a year.
Probably on
the first day of the fourth month of the year, probably somewhere around there.
They've got the joke already, Jonathan. Yeah.
Happy April Fool's Day, everybody. We'll see you on the other side. Bye, freeloaders.
That's so bad, dude.
Oh, man. Okay. Oh, Nacho Bravier, lick your fingers, man. We're going off the deep end. Okay.
Oh, this is great.
Oh. All right.